This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 32. Today on the show, I've actually got one of the top hop geneticists who developed many of the hop varieties we use today, as well as Dave Wills from freshhops.com. I wanted to mention the Beersmith newsletter. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, you can go to beersmith.com, go on the right side, add your email to that newsletter box over there, and you'll get a weekly newsletter with great information and articles on beer brewing. And now, without further ado, I'm going to jump right into this week's episode. Today, my guests are Al Hauenhold, retired researcher from the USDA, and Dave Wills, freshhops.com. Together, they represent some 50-plus years of hop development and growing knowledge, and Al personally developed many of the most popular U.S. varieties of hops while working at USDA. It's an honor to have them on the show. How are you guys doing today?
Just fine.
Just dandy. You betcha. After getting all this connection going, we're doing good.
It's great to have you. Now, Al, let's go ahead and start with you. How'd you come to work at USDA and get into hop research?
Well, that's a long story. My background is actually I was born and raised in Austria and did my PhD in wheat breeding and genetics at the University of Vienna. And then I got a Fulbright scholarship to Nebraska working on wheat breeding. And that led to a faculty position at the University of Nebraska. I was an instructor, and that was from 1953 until 1960. And during that time, I took some additional classes and managed to get an American PhD on top of the Austrian one. And I kept working on cereals, first on wheat and then on corn. And then a position opened up in Washington, D.C. in Science Administration with Smithsonian Institution. So I thought, well, I'm young, why not? I'm going to take a chance. And but I wasn't cut out to sit behind the desk. And there was a position, hop breeding and genetics, that was advertised in my professional journal, Crop Science. And I applied, and out of 20 candidates, I was lucky to get the job. I had never seen hops in my life, but that was not an impediment. What was really attracting my then supervisor was that I had enough chemistry background in addition to genetics. So they offered me the job, and I moved out here in 1965 from Washington, D.C., and with four kids in tow, and started working hops. That was 65, and now looking back over 40 years, I think it was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life.
Yes, indeed.
Now, Dave, I understand you worked with Al for a short time as well at USDA. Is that right?
I did work with at the USDA Hop Research Farm in the 81 and 82, and then started Fresh Hops in 1982. And Al is the one that started me in the business and sent me off to talk to farmers all over the, well, it was actually Bob Coleman is a farm up in St. Paul, Oregon, north of Salem. And that was the beginning of Fresh Hops in 1982, which we're now, 30 years later.
You want to say just a word or two about what Fresh Hops does for people who might not be familiar with it?
Well, homebrewing was barely legal when I started getting into homebrewing in 1980, 81, because I was going to Oregon State University here, which is affiliated with the USDA Hop Research Farm. And I was getting into homebrewing and went out to the USDA farm, and Al said, yeah, well, that's where I first learned hops were green, in fact, because prior to that, the hops that were available to homebrewers were, to be honest, fairly old and brown and, you know, probably 4 or 5 years old. Nothing was green and fresh like I was seeing out of the USDA farm. So that's when I realized that somebody needed to start marketing some good fresh hops to homebrewers. After all, it was only legalized in what I believe in 1976 by Jimmy Carter. So yeah. It was the right place, the right time to start for somebody to start selling some good quality hops. Because after Prohibition, the homebrewers, there wasn't really much of a homebrewers thing going on at all. and until it got legalized, and then it really slowly started building into to the faith, to the state we're seeing it now, which is a very different thing. There's a huge awareness due to the craft brewing and home brewing. It's there's been so much change in the last 30 years, and now of course it goes back even further. So
I would like to add one thing. At that time, the hops, domestic hops available were Fuggle, which was an aroma hop original from England, but it was in very short supply. It was very difficult to obtain. And then there was Bullion and Brewer's Gold, which were so-called high alpha hops, about 10% alpha. And the predominant variety at the time was Cluster. It was an early cluster, late cluster, and a few other cluster types. And they had an average alpha of somewhere around between 7 and 8. But they were just what the major brewers considered the general kettle hop. And that was 95% of all the U.S. hops at that time were clusters. Yeah.
So 95%.
There wasn't much of a choice for home brewers at all there.
Well, now, Al, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is that you're actually the father behind many of the most popular hop variants in the U.S. today, including, and I'm just going to list a few of them, but Cascade, Willamette, Sterling, Nugget, and a number of others. Can you tell us actually what goes into creating a new hop variant?
Basically, in hops, we now consider two different types, the aroma hops and the high alpha hops. Now, worldwide, it has shifted very much in favor of high alpha hops for a simple reason. About 80% of all the hops that are grown commercially now are being extracted there. They make hop extract. It's easier to ship. It's very easy to store. It doesn't deteriorate like fresh hops in a bale would do. So it's easy for the large brewer to get significant quantities of what they call alpha acid, and that's really what they want for their beer there, and the aroma has played a secondary role. With the advent of the craft brewing industry, and they've always been considered sort of a stepchild of the brewing industry, but they put more emphasis not only on the alpha, the bitterness, but also on the aroma, which comes from the essential oils. But most of the aroma hops at the time were imported from Europe. And I kept telling myself, well, there should be a way of producing an aroma type that is very similar to the one for which the craft brewers and the home brewers pay premium prices there. And yet when we can grow them here, maybe we can cut into that market and offer them not only fresh hops at a very attractive price. And that's what really got me into the aroma breeding there. But that was years after I had achieved the other objectives, that is producing high alpha hop above and beyond the 10% that was available commercially boiled in Brewer's Gold, but also an aroma hop that Anheuser-Busch at the time, the major U.S. brewer, was trying desperately to get sufficient quantities of, namely the variety Fuggle, but they couldn't get it there. So they kept importing more and more hops from abroad there. And I thought, well, that was a good way of producing something that maybe attracts them, a hop that is very similar to Fuggle, and maybe they're going to buy some more domestically. And that's what happened with Willamette.
Now, Al, how do you actually go about genetically modifying a hop variant or creating a new hop variant?
Well, there are different ways of going about. The easiest way to produce a new variety is to go out in the field and look around. And if you've got a keen eye, you may spot a plant that is different from all the surrounding plants. And that can happen because of either a chance pollination or a mutation there. And typically what you do then, you collect cuttings and vegetate to propagate that. And that's what happened with the cluster varieties and some of the others there. But as I said, that's the easiest one, but there's no guarantee that you are coming up with something that is very unique and appealing to people who already use other types of hops. The other way is to make a cross between a hops have male and female plants, just like you and I, the human race. There are males and females, and hops are about one of about 30 or 40 different plant species that have male and female hops, female plants. So you have to test the male plant, and you have to test the female plant. And it's easy to test the female because we've got the cones, but it's very difficult to test the males because they do have resin plants and bitterness, but only very small quantities. And it wasn't until we developed tests in the mid-1970s that we could also test male plants there. So once you pick out a male plant, then you make the cross. And then you have to look at a large population and try to identify the one that likely is going to make it in the marketplace. And typically, you're looking at 300 or 400 plants. About a third of them will be males, and the rest of them will be females there. And then you test these female plants, the cones, and of course the yield. And if something is all right, then you go into small field tests in order to assess the quality, the yield potential. And then you do some trial brewing, and then you show it to the major brewers. And if they like it, then you come up with a new variety. And you release it, give it a name, and then throw it open to the public. And anybody who wants to have some starts, typically the U.S. Department of Agriculture would provide these free of charge. I mean, there was no cost involved there. They were public patents there, but available to anybody just for the asking.
And I think the female ones are the ones used in production. Is that right?
Female are the hops that are used for commercial production. The male hops can do two things. They can stimulate the production of the female. That is, the cone, which is the female inflorescence that grows out into a cone, will typically be a size of maybe about anywhere from a half an inch to an inch and a half, seldom larger than that there. If you have a male that pollinates the female flower, and it would typically grow between 20 and 30% larger. And since hops, the farmers are selling hops by weight, not by the percent alpha that they have, what by the aroma, the farmer, of course, would have an advantage to plant a few male plants in a hop yard and get a high yield. However, the brewers historically, and even today, do not like to have male pollination. Hops that have been stimulated to a larger size because for several reasons. First of all, they produce seeds, and the seeds they have an effect on beer, although this is really a debate there. And also, of course, you get a larger cone, but you don't get any significant increase in brewing value there.
So all the seed.
And the seed weight is that's insignificant, but when you make pellets out of it, where you grind them up, then there's the potential that the seed fats end up in the beer and have an adverse effect on the flavor.
So, Dave, once a new hop variety is actually created, how do the hop growers go about commercializing it and growing it?
Like Al was saying, I'll let him answer that question because he has got more history in that.
All you have, let's say you make a cross and you plant 500 seedlings out in the field there. Okay, then you look at them for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. You collect hand samples. You analyze them in the lab, not only for the alpha and the beta, the storage stability, the components of the alpha, which is the humulon, cohumulon, and adhumulon there, and hop varieties differ, particularly in the proportion of humulon and cohumulon. And then, of course, you have to assess the yield potential. And then also, do they produce significantly and in a good, reliable manner season after season there? And after about between 5 and 10 years of testing, which of course the last 3 or 4 years involves a large commercial test, typically 1 or 2 acres there, and then we do commercial processing, baling them up and selling them. And then they go into commercial brewing there. And after all these things have been tested and found favorable, and it's a matter of picking a name and releasing it. Now, all hop varieties have started with a single plant there. I have a single plant, I analyze it in the field, I make cuttings, I vegetate it for propagated, so the new plants are identical, not only genetically, but also in terms of the flavor potential to the mother plant. And then we can go from one plant to 1,000 in typically one season, if that's what it takes, but often we have anywhere from 10 to 20 plants to choose from, and expand it to make an acre or 2 acre commercial plots there. Test them for 3 or 4 years, get commercial bale quantities that are produced commercially and harvested commercially, and maybe even make pellets and then do commercial brewing there. And that's typically a time period of between 10 and 15 years that's involved.
Wow, so it's a 10 or 15 year cycle really to get a new variety completely out, right?
That's right, but you don't want to just until the 15 years are over then make another cross. You make a cross every season or every 2 years because you want to have additional material coming on all the way along there. And the flavor is important. But typically, initially, it was, with the exception of Willamette, which was a flavor hop, the important thing was that we had enough alpha acid commercially produced at this in an attractive price. Because typically, beginning in the early 1980s, the hop industry was influenced by the desire of brewers to get alpha acid and the bittering compounds as cheaply as possible. If we couldn't produce it, they would get it from somebody else. So that's when I really switched to initially concentrate on producing high alpha hops.
So let's dive into something like Cascade. How did a variety like Cascade come about?
Well, Cascade is a very interesting thing. I did not create Cascade. Cascade was found as a chance seedling by my predecessor, the person that hired me, Dr. Stan Brooks, who left the program in 1967, 2 years after I came on board there. And he had that plant from an open pollinated seed collection. Open pollinated means that somebody went out, he had a technician that went out and collected on a specific female plant enough cones with seeds there, and they rubbed them out and planted about maybe 300-400 seedlings out in the field. And Stan Brooks found that one seedling, and he thought, that looks interesting to me. And he, over a period of, that was in 1956, believe it or not. And when I came on board in 1965, he had 20 plants out in the field, and he said, well, they look interesting, but we haven't been able to do anything. But from the analysis that we've had so far, we think it is very similar to the German Halitol Mittelfrei, which was imported in significant quantities by U.S. brewers of Monoma. Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, the only chemistry potential that we had was to do the spectrophotometric analysis for alpha and beta. And we couldn't do the components of alpha beta, that's a homilone, cohomilone, adhomilone. We didn't have the technology. Also, we didn't have the gas chromatography in order to analyze the oils. So we thought that the alpha beta ratio of Cascade, at that time just the number 56013, was very similar to the German Halitol Mittelfrei. And we tried to convince the brewers that they should try it because we thought it was so similar to the Halitol hop, which at that time, particularly Coors Brewing Company in Colorado, could not get enough imported for their brewing needs. So we, Sam Brooks had already left. I increased it then, and we planted a commercial test near Salem, Oregon, actually, Kaiser, suburb of Salem. And in a, at that time, a Fogle yard, it was an aroma hop there. And we tested it for 3 years commercially, harvested it commercially. But every year we had these bales sitting in the warehouse, and we tried to talk to the brewers, and they said, well, that's fine enough, and you just go ahead and grow these hops, and we'll get around to eventually test them. They never did. It wasn't until 1970, 71 that Mr. Coors, the chairman of Coors Brewing, said, well, we can't get enough Halitol. You tell us that this is a hop, it's so similar to Halitol. I will pay $1 a pound for any grower that would want to grow this hop in unlimited quantities. At that time, the best price that Oregon growers or Washington growers could get was maybe 60, 70 cents at best for hops. He was a guy that wanted to pay $1 a pound. Within 3 years, he had so many hops in his warehouse that he couldn't use them. And then out that, oh, wait a little, this hop has an aroma component, and they were just different from the German one. It's so different that we can't do 100% substitution. What they did, 100% Cascade brewing there. They gave an aroma when that guy had the second bottle, and he sort of herb that came through his nose, and I said, well, that's different there. I've never had anything like this before. And then Coors all of a sudden said, well, we can't just use 100% Cascade. We still have to import the German Halitol. And then, of course, we finally got some instrumentation. We could do the analysis. We found out, well, oh, wait a little, the cohomine and the oil composition is different. It's not really a direct substitution, although it's similar. It's an aroma hop. And today, it has a unique niche in the brewing industry worldwide. And I just found out from some of my German contacts that the German homebrewers, which of course are about a decade behind the American homebrewers, because it was the major brewers in Germany that dictated the markets. And now the Germans are dissatisfied with the major brewers, which now many of them are foreign-owned, like our American brewers are foreign-owned. And they want to experiment with the overhops. And they found the Cascade is really a unique one. And they're growing Cascade in Germany now. And we know now that there's one compound called geraniol in the oil that's in the Cascade that gives it a very unique flavor. And many homebrewers like that.
That was great.
To back up, we were almost ready to throw that hop out. After 4 years of having bales sitting in warehouses in Washington and Oregon, and nobody did any brewing, if it hadn't been for Mr. Coors, who offered that unique and extraordinary price, $1 a pound in 1970, was just unheard of. Mm-hmm. For him, we would have thrown it out. We wouldn't have Cascade today.
But didn't Henry Weinhardt's jump on that shortly thereafter?
No, much later. Henry Weinhardt came much later. After they found out, and of course, Henry Weinhardt brewing was much smaller than what Coors was at that time. Mm-hmm. And Henry Weinhardt was perfectly satisfied with Cluster Symposium and Brewers Gold, which were readily available, and a little bit of imported hops and a little bit of fuggle that they could buy there. So for their 800,000 or 900,000 barrels that they produced, they could get enough hops, and they didn't really have to scour the world markets to get aroma hops that they never had enough. They were used, many of these German hops.
Now, Dave, a lot of popular U.S. hop varieties came from English varieties. Can you share with us a few examples of that?
For me? I didn't get it.
But I was going to say, can you share with us a few examples of hop varieties that were developed from English varieties?
Well, from English varieties, that's a good... No. Willamette came from Fruggle. Fruggle is an English variety going back to 1879. It was selected in a golden yard in England by a guy by the name of Richard Fruggle. And he had a keener eye. He found that one. And he vegetated it, propagated it, and it was a good hop. Now, at that time, all the hops were hand-picked. And Fruggle is an early maturing hop. So when you hand-pick, you don't typically cut the plant there. And it was a good yielding hop. But over the decades, when it had been always vegetated, it propagated. And it came to America about in the early 1900s, and particularly in Oregon. And it expanded in Oregon when the clusters, which were very susceptible to downy mildew, which is a fungal disease that was introduced accidentally in 1929 by some growers who brought from rootstock in here. So at that time, most of the hops in Oregon were clusters, and Oregon was the number one hop-producing state in the Union. But clusters were totally susceptible, and eventually they had to give up growing clusters in Oregon. They expanded the Fruggle, but Fruggle then was beginning to be lower yielding. One reason was that when you machine harvest, you have to cut the plant, so you weaken the plant. It bleeds for about 2 or 3 weeks there, and then the regrowth next spring is weaker there. And typically, instead of getting a yield of, let's say, 1,600 pounds, where they were, Fruggle was down to maybe about 1,000 pounds to the acre there. But even then, it was an early hop, and Anheuser-Busch at the time began getting to be a dominant brewer in the U.S. They couldn't get enough Fruggle for their Budweiser beer. And that's what really got pushed over into producing a type of a Fruggle type that was high yielding, and that was Willamette. And I started out with the Fruggle plant. I doubled the chromosome number. It took me about a year, and that's what we today call genetic engineering. At that time, we didn't use that term. And then I had what's called a tetraploid hop. It had 40 chromosomes instead of the typical 20 chromosomes that all the other hop varieties have. And then I made a cross with a selected male that I found in the OSU hop yard here near Corrales. And I came up with a hop called a triploid. It had 30 chromosomes, and it had certain advantages. For one thing, it would yield about between 20 and 30% more than the original mother plant there, and it was genetically sterile. So if we had male plants there, and it would pollinate that hop, it wouldn't produce any seed. So there was an additional advantage of Willamette there. And then Anheuser-Busch had always pushed for increased struggled acreage, despite the fact that Oregon growers got the price incentive to grow more fuggle. They really didn't feel that that was worth their while. And when the Willamette came on, that the brewmaster of Anheuser-Busch at that time, Frank Schweiger, he said, this is the hop that is the closest to the Oregon fuggle that he'd ever seen, and this is the one he wanted. And then the acreage expanded, and it shifted up into Washington also, which of, at that time and even today is a major hop-producing state in the U.S. And Willamette, up until Anheuser-Busch was bought out by AB InBev, which is our AB InBev, Willamette was the major hop variety in Oregon. But now I think AB InBev is switching toward extracts, and Willamette is being phased out in part, not completely.
Mainly by Anheuser-Busch. They're certainly not buying nearest. They were the biggest buyer here in Oregon.
Yeah,
and now they're backing way off on their needs, and at least for Willamette. And we still use it here, and microbrewers are still using it. So demand is certainly not gone away, but it's Anheuser-Busch was probably buying 90% of the crop, and now they're going to extracts due to the new trend in brewing.
And they want to save money and pay back the $54 billion.
Yes, indeed.
They paid
for that brewery. Yeah.
Well, Dave, that brings up a good question, though. I mean, do you think the high alpha hops are eventually going to drive out production of a lot of the, aroma hops and lower alpha hops?
They're not going to drive out the production of the aroma hops, but they're certainly going to drive out some of the acreage, because when you go from clusters, for instance, that were 8% to bullions, which were 12%. And now we have hops that are 20% alpha acid. And then with this advent of this new CO2 hop extract, and the efficiency in brewing is just incredible efficiency. It's something, what is it, about 85% efficient alpha versus if you're using raw hops or pellets, the efficiency is more like 35%. So you've got these hops that are way higher alpha being grown with huge yields, and then using them, turning them into extract, and then putting them into the brew at a much higher efficiency. We just need less acreage of hops, and especially as people trend more and more towards Bud Light is the number one selling beer versus we all love our microbrews, but the fact is, the number one selling beer in the United States is Bud Light, and it has very low BUs, and they're trending towards this extract. So thus, we're going to need less acreage of hops for alpha production.
Well, I would like to add one additional thing. At the present time, I would estimate that about 80% of hops worldwide are being processed either into pellets or the extract being the major one. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, it's easy to ship. So we can, the major U.S. hop processors, of which it's John R. Haas Barth Group up in Washington, or they're worldwide, Germany and Australia. They have subsidiaries there, S.S. Steiner, and there's a few other ones that make both extract and pellets. So both of these compounds are fairly easy to handle. They can put them in a certain quantity in terms of a pound, a half a pound, or a half a kilo, or a kilo, so on, to fit a particular brew of his brewing needs. That's an easy thing, whereas raw hops would be more difficult to ship. Also, the extract will keep almost indefinitely, but at least several years without any loss of any quality, and quality I'm talking about the alpha acid component there. However, what's happening with the so-called mass market there, not only here but worldwide, is that in order to save costs, they not only only use a cheaper product for bitterness, they're also using a cheaper product to feed the yeast in order to make the alcohol. And what's cheaper than anything else? It's a high fructose. They can make high fructose, and they can make the cheapest beer there, and you still get the alcohol. But what's missing in many of these beers is what I call the mouthfeel there. Many of these beers you pour, you hardly have a hit there. Now, you can do that. You can use additives there that are perfectly legal in order to get a hit there, so you can fool the consumer. But eventually, you get to the point where some of these light beers, there's just something missing. I mean, you get the alcohol, you can maybe two or three bottles, you get a seltzer, especially when you watch football and so on. But there's more to beer than just getting a feeling of being tipsy. There's got to be a certain flavor that comes along. And the fact that the microbrewers and the craft brewers have increased every year in terms of production, they show an increase of anywhere between 8% and 12% on average, yeah, whereas the major brewers worldwide are stagnant, or in many countries, Japan being one and Germany being another one that I know of, where the beer consumption actually goes down. So there's more to it than just having the bitterness in the beer. And the craft brewers will continue using increased quantities of hops. Not only do they make their beer much more bitter, but also they have a certain aroma component in there, which can be also enhanced by other aroma components such as raspberries and citrus and so on there. But they make unique beverages that increase in quantities of consumers will like.
Predominantly all malt, all malted barley.
All malt would really make a great beer, but you don't necessarily have to have 100% malt. If you use a certain quantity of malt, it'll certainly help. The more malt, the better, but then you can also use more hops.
Exactly.
Because it mellows the effect of the bitterness. It gives you this so-called malt feel, which is hard to describe, but it's something that when you drink it, there's more to it than just gulping down a beverage that's cold and maybe a little bit bitter there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dave, a few years back, we had a real hop shortage, and particularly for homebrewers, it got really, really expensive. What was going on behind that? What happened there?
Well, part of it was just there was too many hops, and growers were taking out acreage because they just weren't making enough money per pound. And there was just an overabundance of hops, and acreage went out. And then there was a shortage. There was a hailstorm and a big shortage in Germany that hit at that time. And there was not a whole lot of excess hops on the market. So Germany came over here, and because of their short crop, bought up a lot of the excess hops, and there wasn't a whole lot of excess inventory on hand to begin with, so there was no hops. And in the past, a lot of times there was excess hops floating around being stored here and there, and what was called spot market, and or still is called spot market. And now at that point, there just wasn't any excess hops due to the lack of acreage. What would you say, Al?
No, I have to add a little bit more. Yeah. It isn't because the farmers wanted to do it, they were greedy and wanted to make a lot of money.
Right.
That was not the fact. The fact is hops were almost always sold on the futures market. Right. That's, the farmer would sell a crop today that is not being produced until 2 or 3 or 4 years from now. And this is called the futures market there. Mm-hmm. At the time when there was overproduction, the farmers could not cover the future years, so they could not sell the crop there. So the year came along where the guy had not sold most of his hops. So what's he going to do? Is he going to produce anything just hoping that the market would turn around? No, they just simply did not string any hops. The hops were kept in the ground. They didn't plow them out, but they didn't string any hops. Now, some of them even plowed them out there. And then, of course, the acreage was reduced there. But let's take a year that all of a sudden, well, it happened twice now. It happened about a few years ago when there was no marketing order. But back in 1980, when we still had a marketing order, the marketing order tried to control somewhat the total production there. But when there wasn't enough demand there, then the growers simply decided, well, I'm just not going to grow 200 acres, and maybe I'm going to grow 150 acres, and they left the other 50 acres or 100 acres or whatever fallow. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, there was a shortage because maybe there was another crop failure or near crop failure in other major hop producing areas of the world. And then all of a sudden, the market turned around, and that's what happened just a few years ago. But there's a certain psychology they play in the thing. The other thing that happened that many of the craft brewers and the smaller ones, they did not buy hops on the futures market. They did not protect themselves because they could always go into the market and
say, hops were available.
I want 100 pounds of this variety. It was all available, and they could get it for a very decent price. All of a sudden, the major brewers, they had bought up always on the futures market. They were protected for 2 or 3 years down the road there. And some of the major craft brewers had also bought enough on the futures market. But the little guys didn't. And they had to pay through the nose in order to get the hops that they needed in order to stay in business. And sometimes they just couldn't make any beer because they couldn't get the hops. And that's what drove the price up. But it was a certain psychology. And I remember telling the growers, I said, you know, now the market is good. Why don't you sell ahead for the next 3, 4, 5 years? Well, farmers are always a very, very cautious bunch. Some of them did sell maybe for 2 or 3 years, but many of them did not cover themselves for enough years in the future there. And then, of course, the market very quickly found its equilibrium again. And today, I don't know what the price is, but I don't think anybody's paying any exorbitant price anymore for hops.
Well, but I mean, homebrewers are kind of at the end of that tale that you just described, though, right?
And so there was a big response to that high price, and a whole bunch of acres went in, and then there was a huge crop, and then it was mostly high alpha stuff. A lot of these, with homebrewers, a lot of people are concerned about these patented varieties, and we should at some point start talking about these patented varieties such as Amarillo and Citra and Simcoe, which are patented and not publicly trademarked by the USDA. So they're only grown by a select number of growers that hold these patents. And so those are a whole different deal than the varieties that are publicly patented, or they're not even publicly patented, they're just publicly owned, such as the Willamettes and Nuggets and Cascades, all these varieties that Al developed via the USDA.
They're public patents to the extent that the U.S. government was a patent holder and made it available anybody for the asking. So there was no royalty involved, whereas the private, now patented varieties, and accidentally, some of their patenting is absolutely absurd because the way the patents, patent attorneys look at these things, they often sign off with something. I've seen patents that were full of mistakes there, but there's still a patent there. So it keeps a person who is not willing to pay the royalties or is not part of a group sanctioned by the patent holder from growing that particular hop. Now, almost all of these are super alpha hops that have alpha levels anywhere from 16 to 20%, maybe even higher than that, but they all go into extract there. And there's a place for those things, and I really don't begrudge them for trying to make a little bit more money. And some of the growers that are in a particular group, well, they are okay, but that doesn't mean that some of the ones that are not in that group are being driven out of business. There's still a place for them.
Well, I wanted to end the show with a few homebrewing tips. I was hoping maybe Dave, you could jump in first and maybe share some tips for homebrewers.
Homebrewing tips. More hops.
More hops.
And I have to admit, I'm a whole hop fan. Personally, pellets, in my opinion, were developed to grind up the hop and vacuum pack it and preserve the alpha acid from oxidation, and such that because the alpha acid does oxidize, and you want to, in order, because alpha can start at, let's say, 12%, and over the course of a couple of years, it'll go way down depending on the variety. And but as you grind up that hop, you're also kind of, imagine grinding up that hop and then putting it through a pellet die, and then the heat of the pellet die actually kind of, it's quite hot, well over 100 degrees. So they're trying to cool them down now so that they're not as hot, to volatilize some of those volatile essential oils. But I'm a big fan of whole hops, especially for aroma. Pellets are great for bitterness, and you can certainly use pellets for aroma. But whole hops, I think you're going to get a little more essence of the aroma and flavor by using whole hops, and especially in dry hopping. If you really want to get that nice big aroma, at least an ounce of hops in a dry hop at room temperature for about a week. And go for the gusto. Use there's so many great hops now. Shoot, my list of hops that I sell must be 18 different varieties, where Al was just talking not that many years ago, we were only looking at three or four varieties. Were this huge abundance of beautiful hops, and just use lots of hops. And that's going to make, and with whole hops, you get that nice, clean, crisp, hoppy flavor and aroma. You just can't beat it.
There's only one comment I want to make. Sometimes, and I've been at test panels there, but also at private testing, some of the, particularly the home brewers, they think that the more hops, the more bitter the beer, the better it is. And it's actually, there's a balance there.
There is a balance.
You can overdo it there. I've tasted beers that have many BUs. That's way too much. 30, 40. That's a good bet. Spend all that money, not only on hops, but also use a bit more barley malt there and make a beer that got the mouthfeel there, so that you feel that just drinking water there, and you have the effect of the alcohol afterwards. No, use enough hops and it'll give you a bitterness there. But incidentally, some of the major brewers now seem to catching on to some of those things, because they're now making beers that are a little bit more expensive, not quite as expensive as the microbrewers or the craft brewers, but a step in the right direction. And they are using, and I've just tasted one that came out of what I thought was Blitz Weinhardt Brewing Company, a small brewing company up near in Washington. No, they're part of the Miller Brewing Group there, and they have about 25 bittering units, which is a surprise there. So they're finding out that they've got to do something more than just provide alcohol to the consumer. Use enough hops, use a little bit more malt there, and then come up
balance with balance with a big malt with a malty backbone.
Yeah, and have a beverage that is unique there, and something that people will be satisfied with having one or two bottles. Like Joe Coors used to say, well, my average beer drinker is the one that I really like, a six pack a day. Well, that's quite a bit there. I won't drink a six pack a day, but it's not unusual in the summer that I have maybe two with a meal, and that's just great for me. That's how I like my hops, and that's how I like my beer.
Well, it's been fantastic having you both on the show. I really appreciate it, and I did want to put in a plug for freshhops.com. Dave Wills runs that and does a great job providing bulk hops and great prices actually to home brewers. And I also want to mention the spring hop planting season coming up here in a couple of months. And if you missed it,
we were for the weekend trying to get them out of the ground as the weather permits. We had snow here a week ago, but we're digging as the ground is dry enough, and we hopefully have a decent supply ready to go by mid-March. That's plenty. No reason to get too excited and get hops anytime soon, because after all, it's only January. I'm not sure when this is going to air, but I recommend planting hops pretty close to your last frost date in your area, just because they are little babies, and you don't want to put them in the cold, wet ground. And look at your last frost date in your area, and that's a good time, you know, in March, April, May. Great time to be planting.
Well, I want to mention Fresh Hops also sells rhizomes, obviously, and Dave also did a show with me last year. So if you go back through the archive for the podcast, you can listen to Dave talk all about how to plant your own hops. I'm sorry, I cut you off there, Al. Do you want to go ahead and make a comment?
Well, I just wanted to say, don't expect to get a huge crop the very first year. The baby crop is typically, I mean, if you get them up to about 10, 12 feet, that's good enough. They'll heal them up well in the fall there, and then next year you'll be ready to go.
Well, thank you again for both being on the show. I really appreciate it. Really great having a treasure like Al and Dave on the show.
Okay. You just got me at the right time. I've been retired for 6.5 years. Who knows how many more years I'm going to be around, but keep up the good work.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have Al here on film for posterity.
Yeah. All right. We'll have this show up shortly. Again, my guests today were Al Hounold, who's a retired USDA geneticist, and Dave Wills, who runs freshhops.com, hop supplier and rhizome supplier. Well, I'd like to thank Al and Dave one more time for appearing on the show. Really appreciate them being here. I'd like to mention, if you have any feedback for the show, you can join us at the discussion forum at beersmith.com/forum under this episode and leave a comment. Or you can leave a comment at the blog at beersmith.com/blog, where you can also find all of our older episodes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.